Everyone, welcome to the court. We have two cases today. The first one is United States v. Grafton. Ms. Barnes, are you prepared to argue on behalf of the appellant?
Yes, I am.
And Lieutenant Commander Corrigan, are you prepared to argue on behalf of the government?
Yes, sir.
Very well, then. Please proceed.
Chief Judge Olson and judges of the court, may it please the court, I am Kim Barnes and I represent Petty Officer Grafton. Chief Judge Olson, I respectfully request 3 minutes for rebuttal.
Granted.
Thank you. The charges in this case presented two opposing theories of liability, and appellant was improperly convicted of both. The judge's erroneous instructions caused this injustice, and the lower court usurped the member's function by reinstating the incapacity specification and then awarding appellant a sentence on it for the first time. Therefore, this court should reverse the lower court's decision. The judge erred with her confusing and incorrect instructions coupled with allowing the members to convict on two specifications that were charged in the alternative. The government charged these in the alternative. In fact, it won the unreasonable multiplication of charges motion because of this, Joint Appendix 43 and 44. And the judge even said at that time, he can only be convicted of one.
So, Ms. Barnes, in terms of the instructions provided by the military judge, could you summarize what you believe was wrong or mistaken
Yes.
by the military judge?
The instructions, in broad strokes, the instructions taken together with the government's evidence and its argument essentially merged the two specifications into a general idea of the complaining witness being unconscious or asleep and also intoxicated.
So, Ms. Barnes, is it the appellant's position that in light of our decision in Mendoza, because, of course, this court-martial occurred prior to Mendoza, but it's error in light of our decision in Mendoza. Is that your argument?
That is my argument, Your Honor. Defense at trial, even though, as you've pointed out, this trial concluded 11 months before Mendoza was decided, the trial defense counsel did raise essentially the same issues that came in this court's decision in Mendoza. So for both of the specifications, what the judge told the members when she defined consent for them, she told them that a sleeping or unconscious person cannot consent. And when it came to the incapacity specification, she gave a definition of consent. She did not tailor it, which is what defense requested, because they were asking for that in order to argue that he had a mistake as to her, or that she consented and therefore wasn't incapable. But her instruction came out as very general, and it really just muddied the waters in terms of what consent was and what role it would play in these charges. And then, of course, the final piece was when it came to findings, and she instructed the members that they could find him guilty of both specifications, even though they were charged in the alternative, and on the evidence, they simply couldn't both exist.
Now, why is that? I was noting in the JA, page 364, that trial defense counsel, in closing arguments, was essentially arguing the following. It says, the victim, quote, was walking unassisted both before and after that video. She was able to understand and appreciate what was happening when she told the quarter deck watch commander not to call dispatch. But she was capable. She consented. She just can't remember. And based on all the evidence, why couldn't there have been the theory that she initially, when the sexual assault started, that she was awake, but then as it progressed, she became unconscious? So why, in light of the evidence that was presented, in light of what trial defense counsel was arguing before the panel, How exactly was the military judge wrong in the approach he was taking?
The defense lawyer's argument was the only way, I imagine, obviously I wasn't there, that they could try and attack these two diametrically opposed charges. By that point in the trial, they knew the members were going to get to decide on both. And so that's the only reasonable way that the defense could stand up and try and argue that. But in truth, the evidence, there's no evidence of when the complaining witness and the appellant were together in that elevator, except for when the friend comes to the elevator doors, they open, and she sees them on the floor. That's the only evidence. We know from the transcript, in her testimony at page 212 in the joint appendix, she says that the complaining witness got onto the elevator alone, and there is no one at all. In fact, there's no evidence of when these two ever were together in their whole lives, except for that moment in time when they got to the elevator, and the complaining witness is not responsive.
Ms. Barnes, can I ask a question that may not necessarily be before the court in this case, but in this scenario, is the military judge required, and or can the military judge be prohibited from sending both offenses to the members in a situation like this? In other words, the scenario, I guess, that comes to my mind would be earlier in the trial, the parties agree, and the military judge agrees, and the trial counsel agrees that, hey, we have pleaded these two offenses for contingencies of proof, which is what happened here. As the trial plays out and all the evidence comes in, at the end of the evidence, the military judge turns to the trial counsel and says, hey, trial counsel, you pleaded for contingencies of proof. We now have all the evidence. I want you to pick which offense you want to go to the members. And the trial counsel says, well, we still think that the evidence supports both and the members ought to decide. So this is the crux of my question. Does a military judge have to send both offenses to the members, or can a judge decide based on his or her view, having seen all the evidence come in, which one should go to the members, notwithstanding trial counsel's claim that they both ought to go to the members?
Your Honor, the judge controls the courtroom. It's the judge's job to ensure that the trial moves along, that the rules are followed, that the accused rights are upheld. And so in a situation such as you've described, under evidence like this, in this case, so these are very fact-specific, which I know you all know, the judge perhaps should have taken a middle ground and actually agreed with what the trial defense counsel asked for and sent them both back, but instructed the members they could, if they were going to convict, it could only be one or the other.
Okay, that's what I guess I'm getting at. What do you think should have happened with both offenses? Well, two questions. Should the judge have sent them both to the members, or what are the members to do, what are the members told to do once both of the offenses have come before them? And your view apparently is that, hey, look, even if the judge here decided both offenses should go to the members, he should have instructed them that they can only convict on one.
Yes.
Okay.
Exactly.
And you don't see any, necessity, I guess. You're right, the military judge is the one who is managing the trial, but you don't see any necessity to have a rule. Not that I'm advocating for one, but necessarily, but you don't see any reason for a rule that either requires the judge to send them both or that requires the judge to make trial counsel choose one before the actual offense goes to the members. You don't see any reason for that, because in your view, it sounds like he could have settled the problem here by doing what you've just suggested.
Right. And Your Honor, I don't know that a rule is needed. We have to trust the trial judges to be able to sift through the evidence.
Well,
and,
I agree.
And make
I
their
agree.
Decision, right?
I agree. I'm all for trusting trial judges.
So we have this case that's going two charges in the alternative, and trial proceeds along this line. And then at the end, we have the government is changing its tune and now is claiming that appellant is guilty of both charges and standing up and arguing it and says in argument, the accused is charged with two specifications of sexual assault. This is not for two distinct sexual assaults. Rather, those are charged on different theories of criminal liability. And that's at page 344 of the joint appendix. So this is just manifestly unfair to the appellant. And because of these instructional errors, his convictions must be reversed unless the government can show beyond a reasonable doubt that the error did not contribute to the verdict. Hill says an error is not harmless beyond reasonable doubt when there is a reasonable possibility that the error complained of might have contributed to the conviction. Here, if the members were properly instructed, as we were just discussing, to choose one or the other, he literally could not have been convicted of both. So we know this error actually caused the conviction, not just that it might have.
Could you flesh that out, please? I'm not sure I quite understand your point. How is it that if they were instructed one or the other, that we would be in a, you're confident that he would not have been convicted of either one?
I'm sorry,
You seem to be.
I should restate what I said, though.
Okay, please.
He could not have been convicted of both. They certainly might have convicted of one of them. I guess that's.
So doesn't
that's part
he stand convicted of one of them now?
I'm sorry?
Right now he stands convicted of one of them.
Right now he does stand convicted of one of them.
And you're saying that at trial he could have been convicted of one of them?
He could have been convicted of one of them.
So where is the prejudice we're finding here?
The prejudice happened as soon as he was convicted of both. I understand, and I agree, the lower court set aside the non-consent. They reinstated the incapacity. But...
So is there some kind of spillover argument that you're claiming happened here, that if the panel hadn't been presented with both, that in your view he would have been convicted of neither?
He could have been convicted of neither. I mean, I think if we go back and clean up the instructions as a whole so that they're not kind of muddied together and confusing, and we take away that they're going to be able to convict him of both things, I mean, we don't know. If they're properly instructed, we don't know what they're going to do.
Let me just ask a question about the government's brief. Skipping ahead, let's assume, just for the sake of the argument, this is not your position, but that we conclude that the Air Force Court, I'm sorry, not the Air Force Court, the Marine Corps Court, properly found the appellant guilty of Specification 2. Now, they reassessed the sentence, but your argument is there was no sentence to reassess. The government says in its brief, well, in that case, the requirement would be to send it back for a rehearing, but then there would be no cap on the sentence. Can you address that last point, that if we were to, again, assuming that we go all the way through and find that it's okay to find him guilty of Specification 2, and I know that's not your position, but if we were to do that, and then we were to order a rehearing on the sentence, that there would be no cap on the sentence? On the theory that he hasn't been sentenced on it before, so there's no bar to having a greater sentence than what he got.
Yes, Your Honor. I agree with that. I would love to not agree with it, but... Just briefly turning to what the lower court's decision and why it didn't cure the error was, we have the government charged appellant with very serious sexual offenses. He faced it up to 30 years in confinement, mandatory DD, maybe a sex offender registration for life. And it's just not too much to ask that the members who were tasked with deciding his fate should be given the clear and correct instructions. And that's his right.
And what is it precisely in the instructions that was wrong?
Based on the evidence in this case, instructing the members that a sleeping or unconscious person could not consent, really for both of the specifications.
I mean, that's what the statute says.
The statute does say that, but also judges have a role to tailor instructions. And given the evidence in this case, it was more than reasonable it was necessary to tailor that instruction.
To contradict the statute? I don't. When you say tailor the instruction, I guess I don't know what you mean.
To go through what the different definitions could be, and I mean, I judges do this, I think, fairly routinely, is to take out things that don't apply or that are going to cause a problem. So in this case, the phrase of asleep or conscious can't consent is kind of what created a lot of this problem. And you had the government stand up and argue on closing that she didn't consent because she was asleep or unconscious. So you had kind of everything just got mashed up together, because then that spilled into the incapacity definitions as well. Ultimately, the process matters, right? The findings is a function of the members. It's not for the military judge to make fixes. It's not for the appellate court to make fixes. It's for the members to do. And the CCA, the lower court, did not have authority to award the sentence. And he is entitled to a sentence rehearing. Thank you, Your Honors.
Any further questions from the bench? Thank you, Ms. Barnes.
Thank you.
Lieutenant Commander.
Good morning, Chief Judge Olson, Honorable Judge of the Court, and may it please the Court. My name is Lieutenant Commander Philip Corrigan, and along with Colonel Ian Pedden, I represent the United States. Mendoza, Casillas, and Moore all address using Article 120's without consent provision as sort of a Trojan horse to prosecute other theories of liability. But that's not what happened here. First, it's not clear the government could use Article 120's incapacity provision to prosecute another theory, because even if the evidence also supports another theory, the government still has to prove intoxication, causation, and knowledge. But even if Mendoza applies here, Moore tells us that the military judge instructed correctly. The instructions did not allow a conviction based solely on evidence of another theory, as Moore's first principle prohibits, and the instructions allowed convictions on two separate theories, as Moore's second principle seems to endorse. Next, reassessing a sentence always involves a changed sentencing landscape, sometimes including charges the members didn't consider. There's no reason this should be any different when a military judge has followed this court's guidance in Ilescu and conditionally dismissed one nearly identical specification. In sum, this
Lieutenant
court
Commander
should
Corrigan, the authority of the CCA is to reassess a sentence. Once spec 1 was taken off the table, yet spec 2, there was no sentence that had been assessed. So how is it that a CCA is reassessing the sentence?
Your Honor, a sentence had been assessed, and
but not for spec 2.
Yes,
and that's the spec that remains.
Yes, Your Honor. That's always to some degree true with sentence reassessment. In Jackson versus Taylor, the argument was that this was an initial sentencing, because there the appellant had been sentenced for a mandatory minimum for a murder specification. And then the remaining specification was a rape specification that the members could not possibly have considered in formulating their term of confinement. And the Supreme Court there said this is still within the CCA's power. So it wasn't really a literal reading of Article 66C where they're affirming, you know, the exact specification that the members say they sentenced on. And that's also true when the CCA sets aside a greater offense and then convicts on a lesser included offense. Those members never had the lesser included offense in front of them. They only had the facts in front of them when they sentenced. That's a procedure that this court endorsed in United States versus Wells. And so, Your Honor, the government's position is that even though the members didn't have that specification, they had the identical facts before them, and that is fundamentally what happens when a court reassesses a sentence. But in any event,
But to get then to Judge Maggs's point, if it goes back and the CCA say, we're going to not be bound by anything, we can look at any sentence that is authorized under the specific article? Or are you saying that the cap is from Spec 1 applicable here to Spec 2?
Your Honor, if the court agrees with the defense, then there is no cap on resentencing. Because if the court agrees with the defense, then we revert to the normal due process and double jeopardy principles that would stop a trial court, from assessing a higher sentence on rehearing.
And so from the government's perspective, it would be capped at what was the sentence that was adjudged for Spec 1?
I'm sorry, Your Honor. I don't think I understand the scenario.
So in terms of the CCA reassessing the sentence?
Yes, sir.
For Spec 2,
yes,
is it the government's position that the CCA would have a cap of the term of imprisonment that was adjudged for Spec 1?
Yes, in reassessment, yes.
And you're saying that with the approach the defense is taking, then that cap would not apply?
Correct, Your Honor. Then it would go back to the trial court, and then we have a specification that's never been sentenced on at all. And so applying ordinary double jeopardy principles, the judge could sentence to a higher term.
Counsel, let me go back to your first point. Your first point was essentially that under Moore, there's really no problem with sending both charges, both specifications to the panel, and that he could be convicted of both. And there was no problem arguing that. And I assume the logic is that if they didn't consent before becoming incapacitated, then you can have a sexual assault without consent. And if the sex occurred when the person lacked capacity, then you could have sexual assault without capacity. But I think that the defense position was you can't take that position because earlier in the trial you said you were doing it in the alternative. And then you switched positions in the middle and said now we want both. And I think, you know, I think their position is, well, regardless of whether you could do it both originally, you can't say we're doing it in the alternative and then switch. What's your response to that?
Your Honor, the United States disagrees that that's the position trial counsel took. And in fact, looking at the filings on the unreasonable multiplication specification early in the trial, even the defense moved the court to conditionally dismiss specification 2 should YN3 Grafton be found guilty of both specifications. That's at Joint Appendix 486. So early in the trial, even the defense agreed that there could be a conviction on both. And while the trial counsel certainly used the in the alternative language, government's position is that in the alternative is sort of a term of art that's often used in an equivalent way to for contingencies of proof or for exigencies of proof. Courts use all three of these to mean essentially the same thing.
Can you please explain that a little bit more? So when they said in the alternative, they didn't really mean one or the other but not both. Is that what you're saying?
Yes, Your Honor.
Well, why would we view it that way?
The easiest way to know why we would view it that way, Your Honor, is to look at those unreasonable multiplication of charges pleadings and to see what they wrote. And those pleadings pretty much all contemplate findings on both specifications, followed by either a conditional dismissal or a merger of specifications for sentencing. That was the defense's second proposed remedy. And, of course, the defense later argued that these were mutually exclusive, but early in the trial when they were filing the UMC motion, were focused on what would happen if you had two guilty findings. Now,
Morgan, can I follow up on Judge Maggs's question? It goes to kind of what I was talking with to appellate defense counsel about earlier, Ms. Barnes. And could the judge here, I mean, in this notion where we have alternative contingencies approved, exigencies approved, whatever the language is, it sounds like the government is either choosing or the military judge is making them choose which theory they really want to proceed upon. And at the end of the evidence, can't the judge obviate all of this, what happened in this case, by simply making the government choose one of the alternatives? They indicated that they were proceeding in the alternative for contingencies approved. So what's wrong with, at the end of the evidence, the military judge saying, hey, look, trial counsel, you told me you were pleading in the alternative, meaning this or that. We're now at the end of the evidence. I want you to make your choice on this offense or that offense. Wouldn't that obviate what happened in this case?
No, Your Honor, the judge could not do that before findings. The only tool that
he can't make the trial counsel pick which alternative goes to the members?
No, Your Honor, because the appropriate mechanism for eliminating a specification before findings would be an RCM 917 motion to say that there's no evidence on one of them. But if there's evidence on both of them, then the military judge must send them both to the members. How the military judge instructs after the fact is another question. But the government's position is that Alespero lays out a solution that works well, which is...
Well, let me ask you this. Not that I'm advocating for trial judges to conduct an uprising or anything like that, but what remedy does the government have if the military judge does what, I'm not saying I'm suggesting it, but does what I've laid out? In other words, says, hey, look, trial counsel, you told me you were pleading in the alternative. You told me you were going to pick one or the other one. We're now at the end of the evidence. Pick one, but only one. They're not both going to the member. What remedy does the government have? I mean, you can't appeal under Article 62, right?
Your Honor, I think the government could appeal under Article 62. That would be a decision that would terminate proceedings with regard to a specification, but it wouldn't be a finding of not guilty. So I think that the government could petition the CCA under Article 62.
Okay.
So, counsel, before you go on, I want to circle back to focusing on the instructions. The appellant argues that the error in the instructions was the conflation of theories, and that by including the consent definition in both Specification 1 and Specification 2, the military judge conflated theories, which we subsequently in Mendoza said is prohibited. What's the government's position with regards to that? What is there offending language? Is the definitional language contained in both specifications offending language?
No, Your Honor, it's not. And with regard to Specification 2, consent is still relevant to incapacity because if a person is incapable of consenting, members should understand what consent is. But even from the beginning, this Court should consider that argument, the consent instruction on Specification 2, to be waived as invited error. And the reason for that is because the appellant asked for a consent instruction. In fact, filed a pleading, which is in the Joint Appendix, for the consent instruction because the appellant wanted to argue, and did argue, that the victim, in fact, consented. That was his theory. Now, Mendoza's core concern is using without consent as this catch-all offense, but that's not really possible here. Even with the non-consent instruction, even if the members had assumed and just taken it as true that this victim was unconscious, and because she was unconscious, she was incapable of consent, they would still have had to agree with further facts. They still would have had to agree that that unconsciousness was caused by alcohol consumption and that the appellant knew or should have known about that condition that was rendering her incapable of consent. So that Mendoza concern is not there because of these additional elements in the impaired by an intoxicant theory of prosecution. Nothing in that military judge's instruction allowed the members to find him guilty, in other words, of specification two, by merely establishing that the victim was unconscious. The members would still have had to find that alcohol was the cause. Turning again to the idea that these are mutually exclusive or inconsistent theories, the footnote 3 of Mendoza and Moore's second principle both suggest that there can be facts that a victim did not consent before falling asleep or, in this case, becoming incapacitated, and that the sexual act subsequently occurred while the victim was asleep or incapacitated. And here there were sufficient facts for both specifications. With respect to the non-consent specification, there were facts that she did not know appellant at all. In fact, appellate defense counsel just noted how they had no prior history together whatsoever, and that as soon as she regained any level of consciousness, she was pushing him away. There's also some evidence that she may have had some capacity when the sexual assault began through the phone call that her friend indicated she heard some level of moaning on the other end of the phone, which could possibly have been some level of capacity. But the members here had enough to know that she was very unlikely to be the 1% outlier of most uninhibited people that was going to step onto this elevator and have sex with a total stranger. Since there was no interaction, and based on her interactions with him after the fact, and his statements that he deserved everything coming to him, they had sufficient evidence to convict on either theory, and both were appropriate and not mutually exclusive. And finally, addressing one last point of the sentencing reassessment, should this court determine that there was no sentence to reassess, the court should also consider clarifying what military judges should do in light of Ilescu. Because following Ilescu's advice to conditionally dismiss one specification before findings creates a substantial risk on appeal of having to do a resentencing, an entire resentencing, when a reassessment may have been more efficient and more in line with Congress's vision for the CCAs as outlined in Jackson versus Taylor. So pending the court's questions, for those reasons.
On that last one, how exactly would that work? I mean, the military judge would say, well, I think we're going to dismiss specification two here, but I'm still going to send it to the panel to sentence so that we have a conditional sentence. Doesn't that seem a little weird? I mean, you asked us to clarify, and so what we would say is the military judge acted properly in understanding that the military judge could conditionally dismiss one specification, but if he does that, he still has to get a sentence on the conditionally dismissed specification. Is that what our clarification would be?
No, Your Honor. The clarification would be in a unitary sentencing case that the military judge should merge the sentences for merge the findings for sentencing, and in a.
But how would that work, though, if he then dismisses one of the specifications? I mean, then he's been sentenced for both. It doesn't seem right.
Your Honor, I'm not aware of authority that would stop him from being able to do that. But he wouldn't have to do it if he simply, which if we go back to the standard or if we clarify that in situations like this, the military judge can simply merge the sentences for findings. Ilescu found that that was harmless error, if error at all. That leaves it then to the appellate court to decide whether one of those should be dismissed. But there is sufficient information on the record, then, for the appellate court to act appropriately with regard to reassessment. This also, of course, Your Honor, works differently with segmented sentencing. And in those cases, the appropriate remedy would be running the sentences concurrent rather than conditionally dismissing one beforehand. Because otherwise, to leave Lesbrew as is with no clarification encourages military judges to consider ignoring that and committing the error committed in Lesbrew and running the sentence and merging the specifications for sentencing so that they create a situation where there won't be a sentence rehearing later for the sake of efficiency. Pending the court's questions, the United States asks that this court affirm the lower court's decision because it did what the statute allowed and because it followed this court's precedent.
Thank you, Lieutenant Commander Corrigan. Ms. Barnes?
Thank you, Your Honors. The government is now arguing on appeal that there was evidence to support that that this was some sort of ongoing sexual conduct and that at some point the complaining witness didn't consent and then became incapacitated. And so that's the government's position. And arguing that this is similar to Moore and some of the other recent decisions. But the problem is the evidence doesn't actually support those claims. One of the main differences here is this complaining witness said not one single word about consent, not a word. There is no evidence of when the two of them were first in the elevator together. Any statements that the appellant made afterwards certainly may go to consciousness of guilt. They could also go to, oh, I just got caught in an elevator with a half-naked sailor, and that's probably bad. It doesn't mean, oh, no, she didn't consent, and now I'm in a lot of trouble. And the last point the government makes about...
Well, counsel, before you move on, is there any evidence in the record of affirmative consent? That the victim gave affirmative consent of any kind at any time?
No, there's nothing
and
either way.
And isn't our legal baseline that means no consent?
The legal baseline is that the government has to prove that it was without her consent.
Right, but in the absence of any evidence that they knew each other, that there was any kind of consent, isn't the instruction then that there has to be some sort of affirmative, it doesn't have to be a statement, it can be actions, but there has to be evidence of some kind of consent. Isn't that what our case law holds?
But then aren't you asking the defense to prove that?
I'm just trying to understand if a theory of lack of consent, you seem to be suggesting that a theory of lack of consent might be legally insufficient in this case. And I'm just trying to ask, is that consistent with our more recent decisions in Surjack, Hennessy, and Moore?
I'm sorry, can you say that again?
You seem to be suggesting that there just isn't evidence in the record to support a theory of lack of consent in this case. And based on our more recent decisions in Surjack, Hennessy, and Moore, I'm just trying to understand. There seems that there's no evidence in the record that there was any consent prior to the sexual act when the victim might have still been capable of consenting. So given what we decided in Surjack, Hennessy, and Moore, why would the conviction for lack of consent be legally or factually insufficient?
I'm sorry, Your Honor. I see I'm out of time. May
Please
I?
Please respond to Judge Hardy.
Yeah. I think the difference here is that in Moore and Casillas and Surjack, Hennessy, all of those cases, there was
evidence of the two people, the victim and the appellant, actually being together beyond just a snapshot moment in time in order to develop the idea of was this person capable of consenting, and did she not consent or did she consent? That's the biggest difference. In this case, we literally just have this moment in time when Ms. Perez gets to the elevator. That's the first, last, and only time these two people are together. So it's actually just impossible to prove that she was capable of consenting and did not.
Ms. Barnes, Chief, may I ask you one factual question? Earlier you mentioned there's nothing, I don't know if you meant that there's nothing in the record about consent, or that there's nothing in the record about affirmative consent. But, I mean, I thought in the factual setup by the CCA, they mention a statement made by the accused when the second-class petty officer, Master at Arms, petty officer shows up, and the accused says something like, unprompted, unsolicited, I deserve everything that's coming to me, and I know what I did, or I understand what I did. Why would someone say that if they didn't? I mean, to the police officer, which, of course, for the uninformed, the Master at Arms, petty officer is a police officer.
Right. Your Honor, I mean, it could mean that he feels guilty about something. But right. What does he feel guilty about?
I see.
I think that's the real question that's left hanging.
Hmm. Okay.
Judge Johnson?
Thank you. Thank you, Chief Judge. With regards to the sentence reassessment, because I had to write this down because I kept forgetting it. And with regards to the sentence reassessment, in supporting the CCA's actions, the government argues, or they analogize the CCA's actions to what is done in a sentence reassessment when the CCA is reassessing based on a lesser included offense. One, what is your position with regards to that? Do you see those as analogous actions? And if not, why not? What's the error?
Your Honor, I do not see those as analogous actions. A lesser included is always before the members to one degree or another. And so even if it's not specifically in front of them for sentencing, it's part and parcel of the greater offense. Here, we have two offenses that are side by side, as opposed to stacked vertically, if you will.
Any further questions? Ms. Barnes, if you'd like, you may briefly conclude.
In conclusion, the facts do not support findings of guilty on both of these. The facts and the evidence support the idea that these were truly charged in the alternative and that the proper instructions would have allowed the members to either acquit or convict of one or the other, that they would have had to choose which inconsistent factual theory supported which offense.
Thank you.
Thank you.
The case is now submitted. The court thanks counsel for both sides. And the court will stand in recess until 10:25.
All rise. The court stands in recess until 10:25.